a public hearing on House Bill 2608. We heard this bill very briefly last week, but we will do it in earnest today. So we have to open a public hearing on House Bill 2608. Mr. Putman, do you have a brief update on, or anything to add as your that we heard the other day?
No, nothing in addition to what we heard Friday. There is a proposed -1 amendment.
Okay. Representative Bowman.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, I'm Joanne Bowman, State Representative from District 19 in Northeast Portland. I appreciate you, Mr. Chair, hearing House Bill 2608. This bill was put in at the request of a constituent of mine who is a retired individual who is concerned that as a retired individual, he is still required to pay into the personal injury protection coverage insurance program. As you may know, that program is set up so that people who use it and will have an opportunity to use that insurance program in the future continue to pay into it for future use. In my constituent's case, his belief is that since he's retired, he will no longer be able to take advantage of that particular insurance program and therefore doesn't see the need that he should continue to pay into it. I have also suggested from legislative counsel a -1 amendment, and that -1 amendment would change on line 9 on the bill, the first figure, 10,000 to 20,000. And that figure was requested by Jim Anderson from the Oregon Medical Association, and that wasn't something I had a problem with.
Representative Bowman, excuse me, you said you have a -1 amendment doing this?
That is correct, sir.
A -1 amendment that I have doesn't speak to that. So do you have a different -1, or is this a conceptual change at this time?
Mr. Chair, on Friday I requested from legislative counsel a -1 amendment. The -1 that you have in front of you is not a -1 amendment that I requested or supported in any way. Someone else suggested and requested that -1 amendment.
Okay, so there is there's another amendment you have asked.
That is correct.
Thank you. And it changes
Could I ask Mr.
Representative Morissette?
Representative Bowman, what's the nature of this -1 amendment?
That -1 amendment was put in by someone who had a different idea of what should take place with this bill, and I am not educated enough on this -1 amendment to be able to explain why they wanted it. But no one asked me if I wanted it, and I didn't.
You have more? I'm sorry, we were
interrupted. That's pretty much it. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Bowman, would you tell me the dollar amount again?
Yes, no problem.
From 10,000
to 20,000.
20,000, thank you.
Questions?
And actually, Mr. Chair, that amendment was requested on April 21st from Legislative Council, but I haven't received a copy back yet.
Okay. Then we're set.
Is that the extent of the -1?
That's the extent of my -1.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. Of your -1 is to just change the amount from 10 to 20,000.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette.
At this point in time, I'll have to talk about a conceptual amendment because we don't have it.
Yes.
Yep.
Further questions? Thank you, Representative Bowman.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Enjoy your Judiciary Committee. Jack Barnes and Doug Hetherington. Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Barnes representing Farmers Insurance. Today I have Doug Hetherington with me. Doug is the manager of our branch claims office in Portland that handles our personal injury protection claims. We're here today in support of amendments to our amendment to House Bill 2608. This bill has to do with personal injury protection, or what we call PIP. That basically is the coverage on a personal auto policy that pays for the medical bills or wage loss of a party, of a driver or passenger that's injured in an accident. The PIP statute currently provides that every motor vehicle policy in the state that covers any private passenger motor vehicle shall provide PIP coverage to the insured, household members, and passengers. At Farmers, we write a separate policy for each vehicle that we insure in the household. For instance, if one of our insureds owns three vehicles, we would write a separate policy for each vehicle. In the past, this has not been recognized to be a problem. It now appears that the recent interpretation of this statutory language requires that PIP coverage from all policies would apply or stack for a single accident. The effect of that is that if we write three policies, each of those policies has $10,000 PIP coverage for each car, we receive PIP premium for $10,000 for each vehicle. In effect, with stacking, our exposure is $30,000 for each vehicle for each accident because each policy would apply. In contrast, many companies write one policy and list all the vehicles under that policy. Because they have only one policy, they're in a situation where they don't stack. They're collecting premium for the $10,000 PIP, and that's the only exposure they have is for that PIP for the one vehicle. As previously noted, the statute provides that every private passenger liability policy shall provide personal injury protection. Sub 2, small a, currently provides an exception for motor vehicles that are owned by an insured but not covered by a liability policy. The language that we have requested would be to add under sub 2A capital A or furnished or available for regular use, and then go on and that is not described in the policy. The effect of this amendment is that within the household there may be a number of cars and they may not be owned by the same person, and so that's the reason for the language, or furnished or available for regular use. In relation to and not described in the policy would be to specify that each policy then would stand alone and the coverage would stand alone. Really, this is consistent with the way that we always understood that PIP would apply, and it's consistent in that no other coverages would stack. PIP is the only one due to this language that created this kind of a problem for us. It's caused an inconsistency in the marketplace, and so we would request this amendment. Glad to respond to the question.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Morissette?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who drafted this bill? 2608, was that your bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette, 2608 was Representative Bowman's bill.
Is there anything in your bill that addresses her concern in your dash one amendment?
Not really. Actually, we would have some concerns about her concern. The problem with that is it's one of those issues that sounds really good on the surface until you look at it a little more closely, I think. The problem is that her concern is that a retired person not have to pay for the wage loss provisions of a policy. And so it's defined somebody that does not have a remunerative occupation. The problem with that is that in the first place, PIP coverage is really a pretty cheap coverage. And it would be difficult for an insurer to factor out just the wage loss provisions of it. Secondly, the wage loss provisions cover not only the driver, but all the passengers in the car. So even though the driver of that car may not have a need for wage loss, any passengers in the car might. And so I think for really probably a minimal savings for anybody, even if it could be factored out, your other passengers in the car that might need that coverage, it might not be available.
Any questions? Thank you. You have any additional testimony?
I'd like to add one other thing about the wage loss issue. One thing about PIP is it provides loss of income benefits, but as an alternative, it also provides loss of essential services to somebody who's not working. So if a person is not working, but they're disabled and not able to do household chores and other things that they usually do, the PIP policy would also pay $30 a day or up to $900 a month for health for those people. So there are benefits still in the policy for the people who are not usually working.
Representative Gardner.
Yeah, Mr. Barnes, you talked about it was due to a recent interpretation. Whose interpretation was that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, there hasn't actually been a court case on it. What happened was that an attorney presented this to us requesting that coverage is stacked for one of his clients. And our initial response, since the statute has been on the book for I'm not sure how long, but the 18 years, that, you know, it had been on the statutes for long before my 18 years with farmers. At any rate, we reviewed that and, you know, told them that, no, you know, the coverage stands alone, just like the liability portions of the policy would. But then we also referred it to defense counsel, and the defense counsel, after reviewing it again, said, well, you know, he's probably right. It appears that, you know, that according to the language of the statute, it would stack. And so based upon that, then, we began stacking for any of our insurers that were meant to.
Questions?
Have you had a conversation with Representative Bowman to explain to her what you are, what you just said about the benefits that would accrue to a person who is not working? You,
Mr. Chair, Representative Morris, that I attempted to talk to Representative Bowman on two or three occasions, and she didn't have time to speak to me regarding the issue. I did, however, leave her a copy of the amendments last week.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify in this bill that did not get a chance to sign up? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing on 2608. Okay, we will now open a public hearing on House Bill 3622. In the public hearing on 3622, this bill was at the request of myself. I will speak to you about it from here. Mr. Putman, you want to give a brief introduction?
I sure hope I do this right, Mr. Chairman. Right now, there's a description of, in the statutes of what constitutes agricultural produce for purpose of the producer to place a lien against the person to whom he tried to sell the product. Christmas trees are not on that list of produce, and this simply adds Christmas trees to that list, giving Christmas tree owners or growers the same lien authority as other agricultural producers.
Okay. This bill, was introduced because of the problem in the Christmas tree industry. We have a extremely, I believe, time-sensitive product that you can't even give away on December 26th, yet it's not defined as produce for the purposes of the lien law. So the Oregon Christmas tree growers came to me and asked that I introduce a bill to get them into a lien law situation. It's about the only one of the top 10 agricultural commodities in the state that doesn't have some sort of a lien law to protect them. So we researched the statutes and came up this is the best way to do it, to attach it to an existing lien law that's already there. With that, I'd call up Joe Sharp and Bob Schaefer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Whoever wants to start, go ahead.
My name is Joseph Sharp, and I'm the general manager of Yule Tree Farms in Aurora, Oregon, a 30-year-old producer of Christmas trees. We support this bill and request that you help strengthen major commodity produced here in Oregon. This effort to provide producers with the ability to protect their crop value is an important one to us. Over the past 30 years, we have been unable many times to collect payments for our products from Christmas tree dealers who took the crop and sold it outside of the state. This bill will help us to obtain equal treatment with other commodities produced here and sold throughout the country. For many years, producers have needed the ability to protect their ownership position on the trees until they receive payment, but have had very little legal support. Thank you for taking the time to assist our industry in becoming stronger and more viable.
Thank you.
Morning, Representative Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Bob Schaefer, and I represent Noble Mountain Tree Farm. We are a major grower marketer and shipper of Christmas trees, and we fully support this bill. Last year, our company shipped well in excess of 500,000 trees, all to dealers located outside of Oregon. This bill will give our industry an additional tool to collect from dealers, who in many cases are dealers only during the Christmas tree season. I think I can safely say that in excess of 90% of our industry's production is sold out of state. And any help such as this that we can get will only help ensure that our products, you know, grown in the state of Oregon, bring back the revenue to the state, you know, that they should. I would recommend a due pass on this bill. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you. One more set.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of curious, and if you could just explain what the process is now, what your problems are, and how this will change that. I appreciate hearing that.
I have just finished completing a legal case from 1996 into the state of California to collect about $15,000. And had we had a lien position, we could have achieved payment for those trees which were received and signed for in good condition by a dealer down there within probably 30 to 60 days. Instead, it's basically taken us 3.5 years. It's also the other commodities that have a short lifespan, some of the fruits and berries, have the same position. And so many times the products are sold, the money's collected by the dealer but not paid to the grower, and then the commodities have no value on the 26th of December. And this will expedite that and put us in a position, a stronger position, to get paid for the products that we sold to them in good well.
Could I ask, why are you not included in the agriculture, in that group of agriculture products now? I don't understand the exclusion.
Representative Marcet, maybe I should better answer that question. You're welcome to try if you want. I'm not sure when this statute was first drafted, but it was many years ago. Christmas trees have only become a major commodity in Oregon in the past 25 years or so. And so as the industry has grown, there have been things such as this that we have found out that other, you know, major commodities have that we do not have. So that's the attempt at this time. It's simply a dated thing. It's just the statute is probably 50 years plus old. Other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming in today.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify or did not get a chance to sign up on this bill? If anybody's interested, this bill references Christmas tree as a meaning given in 571-505. That is the Christmas tree licensing statute. In order to legally grow Christmas trees in Oregon, you have to be a licensed grower, and this ties the definition into that so that it would only apply to those people who are legally growing Christmas trees. Not yet. We're going to close the public hearing and open work session on House Bill 3622.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3622 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gardner moves House Bill 3622 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. I will declare a potential conflict of industry as I am a licensed Christmas tree grower. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Eckenberg.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
Aye.
Representative Cano.
Aye.
Representative Lunsford.
Used.
Representative Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Used.
Chair
Byer? Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 3622 moves the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming today. Put down both my constituents.
Where do we want to go now? We have 3048 amendments, but I don't see where it's in the planet.
Okay, he's already spoke to his bill once.
just showed up.
Oh. He just were dropped off. Very good. I didn't see where we're supposed to go next. Let's go to House Bill 2738. We'll open a public hearing on that bill. Mr. Putman, would you like to give us another update since we last heard the bill? Do you have any
the update, Mr. Chairman, as I understand, is a technical amendment, amendment requested by the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Do we have that amendment yet? I only think I have a dash one in my packet.
No, sir, I do not.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I dropped off dash two amendments to committee staff this morning.
We'll get copies.
I dropped off 25 copies, so you should have plenty of them.
Do you have it with you, the dash twos?
Yes.
Okay. Hey, Mr. Poole, you want to talk to it while we're getting our copy of it?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. In this bill before your committee last week, there was an 11th hour concern by DMV on the way that was drafted, and you gave me leave to get corrected amendments before the committee today. What you have is the dash two amendments. To remind you, purpose of the bill, if a dealer takes a vehicle in on trade and the title is not available because it's being held by a financial institution, it's important for dealers to be able to perfect a security interest on the vehicle as quickly as possible. So the statute provides for a temporary ownership record. This cleans up the temporary ownership record statutes and extends the time limitation from 30 days to 90 days. That placeholder protects us from the consumer that files bankruptcy shortly after they purchase a vehicle. I'd be happy to answer any questions and commend the dash two amendments.
So the dash two replaced the dash ones, I'm just figuring out right now.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so we can throw away the dash one amendment. What are the differences? I see there is a 2 sub A is somewhat different.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in the original drafting of the dash one amendments, we had two different timelines. In the first part of the dash one amendments, the lien was perfected when the DMV received the temporary ownership record. In the second half of the amendments, the lien was perfected when the temporary ownership record referred back to the date of the sale. So the DMV didn't know which clock to run on, when they received the record or when the date of the sale was. And the current statute is the temporary ownership record goes into effect on the date of the sale. That's when the 30-day clock under existing law or the 90-day clock under the new bill would start ticking.
Okay.
And there were two different time references in the first draft of the amendment. So we simply eliminated one of the time references back to the way the statute currently is, which means the date that the consumer takes the vehicle, which is the date of sale, is when the temporary ownership record clock starts ticking and the dealer has 90 days from that date get the title transferred and over to DMV. We created in the dash one amendments a new definition for the date of sale that we've eliminated at DMV's request. The reason I had that in there originally is you can fill out, let's say you go to a dealership on the weekend, when the financial institutions are closed, in our retail installment contract, we can fill out the entire contract and leave out everything but the financial institutions. You know the terms of your deal, you know how what your interest rate is, what your payments are going to be. But since everything's closed, we leave the financial institution blank, and then on Monday we start shopping the contract and find a financial institution that's willing to buy the loans at the terms that we've offered to you. And because it can take 2 or 3 days sometimes to get a financial institution to buy a piece of paper, what I tried to create in that additional definition of date of sale was to wait until that financial institution had bought the piece of paper, because we obviously can't perfect their lien until we know who they are. So I wanted to start that 90-day clock once we found out who the financial institution was. That created some statutory confusion for DMV, so I eliminated it. Even though we may not know who the financial institution is and we may have to wait 3 or 4 days to fill out the temporary ownership record request through DMV, going from 30 to 90 days gives us sufficient time, even though we may lose 2 or 3 while we're waiting for the financial institution to purchase the paper.
Thank you. Questions, Elizabeth? Representative Morissette.
Thank you. So DMV is happy with your, I mean, they support your amendment and your change of the existing statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette, I can't speak on behalf of DMV. Of course, they're aware of the bill and the amendments. Kelly Taylor from DMV was here last week when the bill was heard and said that DMV did not oppose the intent of the bill, and with the amendments that changing the problems that they had, my guess would be they would be here either in support of or at least in neutral on the bill.
Thank you. Very much, Mr. Dahlminer. Very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? If no, we'll public hearing. Work session on House Bill 2738.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Knope.
I'll move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2738.
Representative Knope moves the House Bill. You start over. Representative Knope moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2738. Discussion on the motion? Representative Gardner, do you have a discussion?
No.
Objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Knope.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2738 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Representative Knope moves House Bill 2738 as amended to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Knope?
Aye.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Yes.
Chair Byler?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2738 moves the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. We're sitting carrier and would like to carry the bill. Since would like to carry the bill.
What are the bills? Chris.
We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 3048. We just received some amendments to House Bill 3048. Mr. Putman has those. We heard this bill a couple weeks ago, on the 7th of this month. At that time, there were some concerns about the language. Specifically, I have in my notes the part about your items are not protected, and the sponsor of the bill is going to go and have some amendments drafted to change that. And we'll see what he has here. We're in a public hearing. Is there anyone signed up to testify on this bill?
Yes.
Mr. Barrows, why don't you come forward and give us. We just got him. I don't know if he's on the way or not.
Okay.
I can't answer that. Tell you what we'll do. We will. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill besides Mr. Barrows? We will close the public hearing and open a work session on the bill. And why don't you come up now?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Dave Barrows with the Oregon Self Service Storage Association, and with me is Amanda Williams, also of Dave Barrows and Associates, who has been working on the amendments with Representative Mannix.
I apologize. We just received them a minute or two ago.
We all understand where it is, that where it's happening in the legislative council. It's pretty crazy. And Mr. Chairman, it's our belief that these amendments are very acceptable to the self-storage folks and would support the bill as amended.
It seems to me, committee members, the amendments do address the concerns that were raised at the first meeting. Is there any other discussion on the
Dash 2? We don't have a Dash 2.
This is the Dash 2. I have not seen the Dash 1. We're getting our concerns.
Dash 1, Mr. Chairman, was just a one-word change in that big, bold thing that Representative Mannix had. And then when we talked to him, he agreed to take that out altogether.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3048.
Representative Gardner moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3048. Is there discussion on the motion? It's pretty quiet this morning. Objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Gardner?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3048 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves House Bill 3048 as amended to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Knope?
Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Marquette?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Bryan?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 3048 before the House with a due pass recommendation. We need a carrier for that one. Representative Marquette will carry that bill. Representative Thompson, Representative Lundquist, while you were in Salmon Committee, we held a public hearing on House Bill 2608, and we held a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3622.
You had a vote on
the
Christmas tree one?
We had a vote on the Christmas tree one. If you would like to vote, we would. I would ask for a suspension of the rule so the two of you could be allowed to vote. Representative Gardner moves suspension of the rules to allow Representative Lundquist and Representative Thompson to vote on House Bill 3622.
You mean I have to participate in you slamming this one through?
Is there an objection to the motion? Seeing none, so ordered. Now, of course, please call the roll on that vote.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
And Representative Thompson?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Close the. I guess we had the finish real quick. Did we? Just,
no.
Yeah, we just sent a rules on the vote.
Okay.
We have House Bill 2661. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2661. We had this bill before us a while back, and the parties, opposing parties, were going to go out and try to work on amendments. We have not seen any amendments. I don't know if we have a sign-up sheet. Maybe someone will come up and talk about it now. Thank you.
Sure.
Like we have Robert Hastings and Jeanette Bartel.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Robert Hastings, AIA architect from Portland, Oregon, president of the Architects Council of Oregon. And hopefully within minutes, the amendment will be in your hand as trying to get the copies down from Legislative Council. But when last you saw Jeanette and myself, we were trying to pass very smoothly mandatory continuing education enabling legislation. And at that time, there was a slight different interpretation of what we were trying to do. And so in the spirit of total cooperation, the Architects Council of Oregon met with the Board of Architects Examiners and discussed what their needs were, what our hopes would be, and have come with an amendment that fulfills both of our needs, and that will be hopefully in your hands soon. The nature of what we've done is we've mutually agreed that the Board of Architects Examiners, which is the rightful body to study, determine, and request adoption of the statutes for regulating the practice of architecture. And this mandatory continuing education bill would allow them to fulfill their rightful and authorized position to look at those programs and methods of providing mandatory continuing education. We agree with that. Ask them if they would allow us to insert language in their proposed amendment, which would ensure that the bill would allow for facilitating reciprocity licensing among states. And that is a large concern for practicing architects. As you know, practice outside of Oregon in other states. So we were trying to find a level playing field, if you will. And we hopefully will be able to do that now with this amendment and allow the bill to move forward so that in cooperation with the board, they can begin to develop the actual program of what would be proper amount of hours of continuing education, what would be the best way to provide that vehicle in terms of programs and monitoring the quality of those programs.
Refresh my memory, how big of a problem do we have with architects that don't have continuing education?
The problem is that the industry and the practice is changing rapidly, and the AIA, as a national organization, instituted a mandatory continuing education program as part of a requirement for membership. What we're seeing in other states throughout the country is a desire to ensure for the public's health, safety, and welfare a level of continuing education. Once we get our license and go through that wonderful process, it's merely maintaining a decent practice and paying our annual fee. There's no other requirement.
That's fine. I've in my experience, continuing education has usually been a means of getting membership dues. And so I'm wondering why we need a law to, I mean, and that's fine. Continuing education is fine. I don't know how big the problem is. But as a general statement, how come we need a law to do this? How come you can't do it within your own professional organizations?
Just to clarify that, then, we do have that as a requirement in our professional organizations. A little over half of the registered architects in Oregon are members of the AIA. And there is a distinction. So the board, the practice of architecture, does not have a requirement for continuing education. So we as an association believe that's important, and there would be no other way, I believe, for the board to mandate that without having a change to the way that they are set up.
Any questions?
One more set.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned public safety. It just seems to me that improving earthquake standards or safety standards would be one important aspect of continuing education. As we learn more about the risk of earthquake and about the vulnerability of buildings, I would hope that all new buildings that are put up have pretty good earthquake protection. Is that part of the continuing education?
Yes, and sort of.
yes, and sort of.
Seismic, Oregon has evolved into a higher seismic zone, which we have to design our buildings to meet. And as buildings are being perhaps remodeled and added onto, many times they have to come up to that higher standard. Structural engineers and architects are allowed to design those retrofits and the buildings for that. There is not a requirement, this is my sort of, there's not a requirement that in the health, safety, welfare education that we have, that there's a specific seismic quotient to that. But in truth, that is, sort of answering Representative Atkinson's point, a lot of our membership, when they do get continuing education, is for that very reason, seismic activity.
Mr. Chairman, may I answer the question as well? My name is Stephen Gafori. I'm representing the Architects Association this morning. Representative Durfler is next door. He was going to come in and make a comment, but he's in the middle of a work session. It's awkward for him to come out. He wanted to express his support for these amendments, and he's been helping us on this together. I would like to say that we have set up some continuing education already because our professional association requires continuing education, and we have done specifically that in our continuing education programs, as Janet Morris said, and that is to bring programs on seismic issues to our membership, and we're very concerned about that. We also might be interested to know our training, our members, we passed a bill last session giving architects exemption from liability if they go in immediately after an earthquake situation to assess damage and to say which buildings are safe and which are not. And the engineers have produced a little booklet on a kind of a handbook on when you walk into a building, the kind of things to look for. And we've been working with closer with the engineers on exactly that kind of thing so that if there is an event that we can help the community in a very rapid situation know where it's safe to go into and where it's not safe to go into. So we're very much aware of the need for that and are already involved in educating our people on those issues.
Well, I'm just going to make a comment. I agree with Reverend Atkins from the standpoint of
so many times I think we pass laws to do things that ought to happen anyway. But the other side of the coin is from the public safety standpoint, whenever we license a lot of people, we have to, and just, I think that's the, I guess, the foundation which we make those, although I agree, it's like we pass bills that require state agencies to work together, which is nuts. But we do that because that's going to get done otherwise.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lundquist, I know that wasn't a question, but I would like to state that not all members of the professional the profession are members of the professional association. Right now, our required continuing education is only for AIA members. And what this bill would do would be make it required for all art licensed architects, those that are not AIA members as well.
Thank you, Representative Morissette.
Well, I think it's nuts to have to require that state agencies do something that they're supposed to do, but unfortunately, they don't always do it.
I agree.
Comment.
Thank you very much.
Oh, Mr. Chairman and committee members, can I respond to Representative Morissette?
State your name first.
Jeanette Bartel, Administrator of the Oregon Board of Architect Examiners. Continuing education requirements are required by many professional licenses. For instance, my sister is a hairdresser, and she's required to complete continuing education. We need to have it in statute in order for us to require it of our licensees. We just can't simply require it because it's right. So we would ask that you allow us to have this in statute, this statutory requirement for us to ask licensees to satisfy these requirements on an annual basis.
Thank you for the questions. Thank you very much. Does anyone else like to testify? Seeing no one, we'll public hearing. We've just been handed a fiscal on this. I need to discuss it with the Speaker's office, so we are not going to go into work session today on this issue. It does have a fiscal, but because it's coming in the Senate board, I don't know exactly what the status of that is, so that's it. We can put it back on the schedule for later. With that, we have House Bill 2965 on our agenda today. We do have the amendment for 2965. Representative Wilson is not here. Apparently, he's not here today. We'll open a public hearing for House Bill 2965. Annette, you'd like to come and speak to it? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, morning. Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. I believe you have, not sure, do you have the dash ones in front of you?
We have dash one amendment.
Okay. Representative Wilson actually had his committee canceled this morning, so he wasn't aware, I think, that he needed to be here, so staff apologizes for him. The dash one amendments would make clear basically how we would currently interpret our law that someone who is a volunteer is not covered by unemployment insurance. We also want to make clear that the reference to the types of employers here are really not inclusive in the sense that if you really volunteered for any type of employer, we would not require that you be covered by unemployment insurance, as long as there's not an employee-employer relationship. But for purposes of Representative Wilson, I believe that he wanted to clarify that for the Gospel Mission constituent that spoke to you earlier. So we would certainly be glad to do that for purposes of the mission. We would want to make it clear, however, that if it was an expectation that they work in exchange for room and board, that there still may be an issue of employee status. But if they're able to just be at the mission for purposes of getting services there as a volunteer, that's fine. They can work if they wanted, and we wouldn't have any problem. I also didn't know whether we had previously clarified, but that they are reimbursing employers, so they don't get taxed. As a nonprofit, they are able to only pay a claim when someone files. So that is how they're currently structured. Glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. So are you saying that remuneration, as the term used here, does cover what you're talking about from the standpoint of they get no room and board?
If they, Mr. Chair, Representative Lundquist, unfortunately, under federal law, we would if they did get room and board and were required to work to get that, that yes, we would if they filed a claim and they had sufficient remuneration to make a claim, potentially consider them an employee. If they are merely volunteering at the shelter and happen to get room and board as well, then there's no issue. So this just clarifies that if that's in fact the case, then we would not consider them an employee if they filed a claim.
Reverend Wilson's not here, but I guess I'm not sure in my mind whether this covers what he wants to cover or not.
I don't believe it does. I don't think we can get to where he wants to go.
Okay.
Yeah. This is about as close as we can get, I think, is what the issue is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Blancas, we did work with him to see if we could get his situation covered under a federal exemption for sheltered workshops, and we talked to the federal government back in the national office, and unfortunately the current federal definition of that does not cover his facility, and I believe that he is going to work with the congressional delegation to see if he might be able to expand that definition to include something very similar but not quite a sheltered workshop. So we can't quite get there under state law.
President Thompson, are we in work session?
No, we're not right now, but we're going to be there soon.
I guess the word sufficient is opens the door real wide. I mean, whatever that is. And that would become with the filing of the paper, I guess.
Right.
Talbot, if a person who everyone thought was a volunteer but did in fact file a claim,
mm-hmm.
You said that they're a reimbursing employer, but my question is, if you found that that individual had in fact been required to work, would your ruling that he was an employee and therefore subject to unemployment insurance apply to that whole facility from then on, or just to that one individual?
We always look at the individual case, Mr. Chair, excuse me, Mr. Putman, we would always look at the individual case and do an actual determination of whether or not, what were they told? Were they told that in order to stay there they had to work, or were they told, you know, we really appreciate people who stay here volunteering? And I think the Gospel Mission understands that that's something that they have to work within now.
Close the public hearing on Hospital 2965. Open the work session. Representative Thompson.
I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2965.
Representative Thompson moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2965. Is there discussion on the motion? Objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Thompson.
I move House Bill 2965 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2965 to the floor of the House that have amended the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Thompson.
I would hope that we'd get this problem resolved at the federal level, because I think it has the potential to cause some real problems in this area that's so needed in the state. But this is probably the best we can get in this situation, so I'll be happy to bring it forward.
Okay. Representative Thompson, after our first hearing on the bill, you and Representative Wilson and the person from the Gospel Mission went and talked with the governor's office. Were you able to do anything at the federal level with that? I mean, get something moving, or do you know yet? Or
because of the lack of time, I wasn't able to stay with him, but I did set it up and bring it on their schedule. And then I also took him to Senator Shields' office, who's very knowledgeable in this, in the conversation. And that's one of the reasons that this came forward, I believe, from those discussions. And sorry, I wasn't able to stay with him all the time to hear all the answers. So.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for working with us. Any further discussion on the motion? Call the roll.
Representative
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2965 was the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Gentlemen, what I thought was going to be an extremely long agenda today appears to be over.
Gee, that's too bad.
We have House Bill 2608 that we had a public hearing on this morning. We're going to bring it back on Wednesday's schedule. Or work session at that time. Other than that, we got through our agenda. So, thank you very much, and we are adjourned.